need to support feedback.
Okay, welcome to this meeting of the Computer Users Committee. Today we have Louise O'Neill, who's the Associate Director of Library Technology Services, who talked to us about e-scholarship at McGill and the great steps forward that you've been making in that area. So thank you very much, and Louise.
Thank you. Thank you, Gord. It's my pleasure to be here, and I have to doubly thank those of you who are here in the room with me because, of course, we have some very strong competition with the inauguration of the American president. So fortunately, this is being recorded as well. So if anyone wants to see it afterwards or hear me speak about this afterwards, they'll be able to, and I hope they do. But once again, thank you for being here and being a live audience with me. It's always much easier to work with a live audience than just talking to a camera. I do want to mention that we do have an e-scholarship at McGill coordinator who would ordinarily be doing this kind of presentation. The reason I mention that is that I have spoken to the CUC, the Computer Users Committee, less than a year ago. So I'm not quite the attention hog I might appear to be, but this is something we do want to tell you about. And I know that when the e-scholarship at McGill coordinator comes back, she's on parental leave, she'll be able to pick up where I left off. But we do want to get the message out about e-scholarship at McGill. I've also been asked to mention that there's no coffee, and what I was instructed to say was that this topic is hot enough already. And you know what? It is. It really is a very, very hot topic in librarianship, in scholarly communication and publishing. And I hope to convey a little bit about it to you today, because e-scholarship at McGill, I will tell you about it itself, but it's really impossible to describe it without putting it in a much wider, almost worldwide context. And so I'll be doing a little bit about that as well, and then I'll welcome your questions. So to get started, what is e-scholarship at McGill, and what is its purpose? Those of you who have not visited our e-scholarship at McGill website, which is on the library pages, this is what the homepage looks like. It's a very simple, unassuming homepage, quite sparse actually. And if you can't read it, there's a search box, and then there's e-prints. It contains e-prints and e-theses, and I'll describe what those are in a minute. But again, very simple, very approachable. It is, in fact, a website of digital documents. And if you look on our e-scholarship page, we define it as a repository as well. It's a digital repository which stores and showcases the publications and theses of McGill University faculty and students. The repository exists in an online, open access environment, making it easy for researchers all over the world to find and access the university's published research output. I don't usually like to read from slides, but I thought that might be a good way to situate it for those of you who may not be familiar with it. So it really is it's a repository. And in fact, this is a whole worldwide trend. And what it is now becoming, the genre is now becoming known as an institutional repository. And in fact, that's more and more now the way in which we are referring to it, the idea that it's a repository of the institution. Clifford Lynch, who is the president of the Coalition for Networked Information, said this about it. And this is, again, trying to put it for you in a broader context. I'll give you a moment to read it. Because, in fact, this is what we are trying to do with e-scholarship at McGill. In fact, we have an even more ambitious vision in some ways about e-scholarship at McGill, or a way of looking at it, and that is this. Our vision of e-scholarship at McGill is that it will be no less than a digital treasury of McGill's intellectual output, the collective genius of McGill. So once again, I show you the same page, but I hope that now you may be looking at it in a bit of a different way when you know what's behind it. This is a in many universities are using institutional repositories as marketing tools, as ways of measuring scholarly publication, bibliometric purposes. These are all happening all over the place, and not consistently. There's more being institutional repositories vary tremendously right now. And ours is, in fact, a very simple one, but it's one that we hope will grow and will change. So what is in our website? It's because it's a website. It's a browser-based repository. Well, as of yesterday, we had 4,952 e-theses, which are electronic theses and dissertations. And these are mostly submitted through the Graduate and Postdoctoral Studies Office. We work very closely with them, and they are strong supporters of the institutional repository. They had a contest last year with laptops as prizes to students who would submit their theses electronically rather than in print. So they're very, very good partners of ours. We've also been quite busy adding older theses into the repository. ProQuest, the PQDT database, which is we also make available through the library because it contains theses from all over the world, not just McGill, but we've purchased those as well so we can put them into our own repository. And in fact, we've just bought 15,000 of them, which we're going to be adding soon. So we'll greatly, greatly expand the number of electronic theses and dissertations. In addition to the theses and dissertations, we have 462 e-prints, and this is the term that is coming to be used to describe these other things, which are journal articles, published journal articles, preprints, postprints, conference papers, technical reports, working papers, and other items deemed to be of value to the scholarly community. You may notice there's a discrepancy in the figures. You may be wondering why are there so many more e-theses and dissertations by a factor of 10 than e-prints. And of course, there are reasons for that. We have a process in place to submit electronic theses. It all happens automatically. And in addition to that, we're putting in older ones. It becomes much more difficult when we get to e-prints. Especially the published articles, because often we run into copyright difficulties if something has been published. Sometimes the members of the faculty or the researchers have signed away their rights to something, and then they are no longer able to put it into an institutional repository like ours. And that's why we talk about things like preprints and postprints, but there's no doubt we would far prefer to get the actual journal articles into the repository, and that is something we are working on. We do, in fact, assist researchers, members of faculty, to the greatest extent possible who want to contribute something. We will call publishers, we will attempt to negotiate with them, we will advise any contributors of copyright, we'll try to answer their questions about copyright. We try to reduce as many barriers as possible to contributing to the repository. This makes us a little different from some of the other repositories where they do rely on the contributors to actually go through the work of submitting their documents themselves and doing all of that, but that's not our approach here because we do want to, as I say, remove as many barriers as possible. So we are trying to become more and more proactive in contacting members of faculty if we see something that has been published that we think would be good to put in the repository. We are starting to contact them. We want to take an extremely proactive role. What you see here is a results page of a search. I just wanted to give you an idea of what that looked like as well. You see that the documents, well, maybe you can't see, they're in PDF format. That's what these little symbols are. And you can email them, you can download them, because this is all freely available information. Since this is the Computer Users Committee, I thought I'd talk a bit about the computer technology as well. We use the Digitool repository system. It's really a digital asset management system. And it is sold by Ex Libris. Ex Libris are also the people who make our library catalog software. And so Digitool integrates very well with their products. For example, another initiative we're undertaking is to link the documents that are in the repository directly to our catalog so that when you click on them from our catalog, the document itself will open up. You won't have to go look for it any further. We're aiming to make things one click away as much as possible, and the fact that the two products integrate so well certainly helps us to do that. The repository is searchable by full text, by keyword. You can search by faculty and department, and there's also an advanced search feature as well, where if you want to specify specific fields within the repository, you can do that. As I mentioned, you can download, you can email PDF documents to yourselves. We find the user interface, the one I described as simple, perhaps maybe a bit too simple. Digitool has an API that we're working with to try to perhaps make the user interface, perhaps it's not so much simple, we don't feel it's all that intuitive either. It looks a little bit old-fashioned. We're going to see if we can modernize the interface. And one of the drawbacks of Digitool right now, which is becoming increasingly significant, is the fact that we can't produce many reports. And the reason that's becoming significant is that one of the greatest inducements to have a researcher contribute something to the repository is to be able to report back to him or her, or even, as in some cases, allow the contributor to check himself or herself how many times his or her contribution has been viewed, how many times it's been downloaded. That's extremely powerful to be able to do that, and we can't do that in Digitool right now. However, Ex Libris is adding report functionality using Eclipse software, so they promise us that's coming soon. We're looking forward to that. And finally, the Digitool repository technology supports open access, which I will speak about a little bit later. We also use the PDFA format, which is the archival PDF format. And the reason we do that is that, of course, we are keeping these documents for the long term. So use of PDFA format, which is an ISO standard, it's not, believe it or not, it's not owned by Adobe. It is open source, but it is based on the PDF format. It's intended to ensure that the document will remain readable and accessible in the future, no matter how the other what other underlying technology changes, and it will look exactly the way the contributor intended it to look. So again, we often have to assist, and sometimes ICS helps us to assist as well in contributors, because it can be a bit tricky to convert to a PDF format from Word, from LaTeX is particularly difficult, but we do offer assistance there as well. Open access, a large component, a large driver for the many institutional repositories that exist is to support open access. Open access being openly available to anyone on the internet, on the web. The open access movement was largely considered to get its start in 2001 when the Open Access Initiative, Budapest Open Access Initiative, was signed at the Open Society Institute conference. Again, I'll give you a moment to read it, because this is the defining document. So this is one of the objectives of e-scholarship at McGill, is to support this. When I mentioned that DigiTool, as a technology-supported open access, what I really meant was that it's OAI PMH compliant. The metadata is what I'm sure, also known as tags in some circles, but it's what we use to describe the contents. So the metadata is harvested. Literally, robots crawl, grab the metadata, and create links so that our e-scholarship at McGill becomes accessible in a number of other areas as well. It's not the actual documents, but just the links. The links lead back to our site. So the Open Archives Initiative Protocol for Metadata Harvesting, OII PMH, is described there. Again, I'll give you a minute to read it. And to give you an example of that metadata harvesting, you may have heard about Cuisine, which was the e-journal that was launched last week. It was on the website. It's an e-journal that is being produced by the Faculty of Arts, and it is being published by the library. So we're pleased to be participating in that. And Eruzi, which is located at Université de Montréal, is the distributor. The only I mention that because you may have heard of Eruzi in that context. But Eruzi, as you can see, is also a harvester of metadata associated with theses. And so they've picked up on what we have in e-scholarship at McGill. So open access, obviously a very strong influence on what we're trying to do, but of course there's another domain which affects e-scholarship at McGill equally strongly, and it's almost the opposite of open access. Any guesses what I'm talking about? Sorry. One more slide on open access, then we'll get to what I was talking about. Open access also includes free open access journals. So, for example, Cuisine, which I just mentioned, is an open access journal, freely accessible across the world. Disciplinary repositories. We have institutional repositories, which are like e-scholarship at McGill, associated with McGill, and disciplinary repositories, which can coexist quite nicely. The physics community, particularly the high energy physics community, is incredibly strong in this area. And in fact, they've set themselves a goal of having all literature related to high energy physics be openly accessible. Open access applies to blogs, websites, and there's a business model that's emerged, which is that the contributor pays to publish and is free to read. Obviously not with us, but that is a model that exists elsewhere, also with publishers as well. And finally, I just wanted to point out two recent historical moments in open access history. In 2008, Harvard and Stanford faculty voted to mandate open access for scholarly articles. It was not the entire university with Harvard, it was the Faculty of Arts and Science and Stanford Faculty of Education, but still significant that they would move to mandate that. And in fact, the question arose at our Senate last year as well. So again, with apologies, any idea what I'm talking about? The opposite of open access is? Sort of. Copyright. That's the almost the flip side. And as I mentioned earlier, it certainly causes difficulties when we are talking about published articles. So there have been tools developed to deal with that, and as I mentioned, we do help contributors or would-be contributors with these things. One of the most significant is the Canadian Author Addendum. SPARC is the Scholarly Publishing and Academic Research Coalition. It's part of the Association of Research Libraries. And there is an American version, but there's now also a Canadian author addendum. And again, I'll let you read it, but what I can say is that the addendum, in a nutshell, there's various levels and various types, but in a nutshell, it's an addendum that allows the author to, even though they are publishing something, to contribute the article. It gives the author the rights to contribute the article to anything that is a non-profit or anything that is an institutional repository or a disciplinary repository. So all other commercial use is off, but it does, as a general rule, this addendum specifies that institutional repositories and digital disciplinary repositories in particular are okay to contribute to. So it relieves the author of worrying that they're breaking copyright somehow. The other thing I should mention is that we do refer to copyright very collectively, but in fact it is the agreement itself, which is not exactly copyright, it's the exact agreement that the author signs with the publisher that may prohibit them from contributing to the repository. Another tool that has been developed to deal with copyright issues is the Creative Commons. The Creative Commons provides almost alternative copyright licenses, what they call reasonable and flexible copyright licenses to support sharing of information. In some places, it's called copyleft. This sort of agreement is referred to as copyleft rather than copyright. And it doesn't mean that the contributors or the authors completely give away their rights, but what it means is the author can specify you can use the document for these purposes. For example, for non-commercial use, you can do it as long as you cite me. Again, there's various types, but in a nutshell, that is the concept. There is now a Canadian Creative Commons site as well, which is very recent. And in fact, I've licensed this PowerPoint presentation under Creative Commons. It's not showing here because it would show up in a website, but this is just a PowerPoint. So I'm basically saying to the world, you can take this as long as you don't use it for commercial purposes and as long as you attribute it back to me and as long as if you make it available, you make it available under the same terms that I did. So bringing it back to the library's role is to, one of our roles is to advise and assist contributors with copyright issues. We tell them straight away that under the McGill University policy on intellectual property, they retain the copyright of their works, even though they deposit them into our repository. And in our brochure, we say that we tell our contributors what we will do for them. We will place the versions of the documents for them. As I mentioned earlier, in many other places they have to do that themselves, but that's not been our approach. We'll verify any copyright permissions that need to be verified. We will create metadata to describe the work, and we load it together with the actual digital document. We embed it, and we enable access by major search engines, and that's done by the metadata harvesting that I described earlier. So from our point of view, there are many benefits to the contributors. It becomes visible on the internet. Major search engines can find it. It itself is full text searchable. It's easily accessible. It's cited, and there have been studies to prove this. There is a lot of research actually being done now on the impact of these repositories, even though they're still in a state of flux. You will be cited more frequently. If you have, as a general rule, if you have something in an open access repository, It receives the widest possible dissemination. You're increasing, the contributor is increasing their profile, their impact on the community. It satisfies open access publishing requirement of funding agencies. For example, CIHR is now making that a condition of any medical research, that it must be made available, openly accessible and available. And we are preserving these documents, this intellectual treasury for the future. There are still some negative aspects we're working with. From the contributor's point of view, there's still a perception that repositories are not prestigious, or at least not nearly as prestigious as being published in a very significant journal in one's discipline. That's understandable, but again, they're not mutually exclusive. You can do both, would be what we would say. That there's no peer review involved with open access, which is, again, not true. There are many peer-reviewed open access in general. And there's publishers are obviously feeling threatened by the open access movement, and they do some of their own marketing and politicking as well. So this is something that we have to deal with, but we are not alone in dealing with it. To bring it to a wider worldwide context now, just to show you where we are with relation to the rest of the world, this is OpenDoor, the Directory of Open Access Repositories. The chart is the proportion of repositories by continent. Europe is way, way ahead of everybody else. In this area, they have 48%. European Union, the EU, has deliberately stated that they want to become a world leader in this area, and they are funneling tremendous resources into this, and that's being reflected here. North America is 29% with 375 repositories. If you're wondering how many Canada has, I checked this morning, and it was 40. I saw some duplication there. For example, Érudit is listed twice, once in its own right and once as part of Université de Montréal, but 40 is probably still a good number to work with. So that leaves 335 repositories in the U.S. So we have some catching up to do. This is an example of the way in which the European Union is supporting the open access movement. They have this project, this vision called DRIVER, the Digital Repository Infrastructure Vision for European Research. And in fact, other non-European institutional repositories are starting to use their technology as well. I was at a Spark meeting in Baltimore last month, and Japan is getting into it in a big way. It's interesting. Japan, there was a Japanese representative there, and going back to the benefits of institutional repositories, the way they're talking about IRs in Japan, they're calling it a cure for interlibrary loan, meaning that you no longer have to go through interlibrary loan. It's all up in the repository, freely available. And in fact, I had that experience myself. There was a member of the Faculty of Medicine who had been contacted by a researcher overseas who wanted copies of his papers, and for some reason did not go through interlibrary loan or couldn't. I'm not sure what. And all he had to do was say, they're all in the repository. Look there. So, in a way, I guess it is a cure for interlibrary loan. And also, some of the theses that are in the repository, as you might imagine, we have many, many theses still to be scanned and put into the repository. And sometimes they get requested on interlibrary loan. When that happens, we will scan them and put them into the repository right away. So we're doing a little bit of catch-up there as well. But Europe is, in many ways, they've got the resources there, and they're coming on strong. So they are the leaders in this area. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And if you aren't convinced yet that institutional repositories are a phenomenon worldwide, I'm going to show you two other things that might help. Two other parties are starting to become deeply involved and interested in IRs. Here's one. Google is developing its institutional repository software. This is very new. And the other one is Microsoft. Again, in beta, very new. But I think that's strong evidence that this is being considered a very serious and genre and movement, and one with legs, as they say. It's not going to go away. Institutional repositories are just going to grow. Oh, I just wanted to mention, I think it's interesting that they call second line down. I've never seen this term before, an organization's repository ecosystem. Again, which I take as an indication of the flux of the different thinking out there about what an IR really is. What we envision for the future for our repository in terms of achieving that vision of being a treasury of the collective genius of McGill, we're looking at moving closer to what is called digital curation. We're looking at managing the whole life cycle of research outputs in digital format. JISC, which is the, again, European Joint Information Systems Committee of the United Kingdom, has a whole digital curation center with many toolkits and much advice for librarians to follow. What's interesting about that aspect that may not be obvious is that we're talking about curating or managing documents or data that have not yet been published, which is something very new for libraries. We're ordinarily dealing with published things. This is unpublished. This is while it's still being developed. And that's also part of virtual research environments for storage and accessibility of research outputs. The vision is that the eScholarship at McGill would be an environment, a tool that researchers can store or place their data, not necessarily just for themselves, but for others as well, to see before. This is while they're still doing their research. We are looking to move to curation of data as well as documents. This is something Susan mentioned at the last speech that Sylvia gave, and in fact we have a little bit of this at McGill, that in a very small way that we're starting to do this. Again, this is somewhat different for librarians. We're used to dealing with documents, not data itself. And again, if we are if we deal with data at all, it's published data, and it's put out by Statistics Canada or some body like that, but not data while it's still raw, while it's still being produced by researchers. But we have to come to terms with that. How do we describe it? Do we use the same metadata to describe data as we do documents? These are all big questions in librarianship. We would look to support repurposing of institutional repository content. You may have noticed a little bit back, I meant to mention it. If you'll indulge me, I'll just go back, see if I can find it. There. When I talked about PDFA format, you see that little gray line at the bottom. That's meant to be a whisper of sorts. You could say it's because I was running out of room on the slide, but and that's part of it too. But then that was almost more of a note to myself. There is also a movement, is probably too strong a word, but certainly a number of adherents to open access are saying, and I quote, "PDFs are evil." And if you Google PDFs are evil, you'll find a lot of information. And the reason they say that, and the reason they say it's contrary to open access, is that PDF documents are closed. You can't go in and reuse the content or take chunks out or move it around the way you can, say, with a Word document. And that is considered unfriendly to open access because the whole idea is to share, and the reason for sharing is to allow researchers to use your information, your data, and use it for something else as well, or use it for their own research. That's all called repurposing, and you can't do that with PDF formats. So there are those who are saying PDFs should not be in institutional repositories. Of course, the reason we use PDFs or PDFA is because we're preserving. So again, we have this tension between preserving a document the way it is, the way the author wanted it to be, and allowing other people to come in and do things with it. I have heard open access adherents refuse to use PowerPoints because they'll just come up and talk. They will actually say, I'm not going to use a PowerPoint because PowerPoints are perceived as not open access. You can't go in, and you can in theory, but it's too static. The whole idea of the emerging idea is as information as a very fluid medium, which librarians will have to come to terms with. But it's a whole different mindset for librarians than we've been used to. And finally, the idea that you don't take just the data or the documents or the contents of the repository, but you also somehow capture the way in which other people are looking and using that repository, capture that and turn it into content itself, which is a very new idea. But some places, MIT, for example, is using their repository in that way. It's quite interesting. So for libraries and librarians, this is an enormous sea change, but it's one that we find incredibly exciting and compelling, and it gives us the energy to work with eScholarship at McGill to turn it into the kind of repository that is extremely useful to fulfilling the mission of the university as a whole. The Association of Canadian Research Libraries put it a very good way. I didn't want to clog up all the screens with quotes, but the way they put it was, ACRL sees a need to vigorously reorient all facets of library services and operations to the evolving technologies and models that are affecting scholarly communication. As information is increasingly captured, created, and communicated in digital forms, the activities of making scholarly communications well-structured, discoverable, archived, and readily available move closer to the creators of the knowledge, who are largely faculty and students. And understanding and influencing that shift is central to our goal as librarians. And finally, if I can, having talked about the future and visions, if I can bring you back, end with a quote from the past now, which is relevant to institutional repositories and eScholarship at McGill. This is what we're trying to do. And I've put a number of links at the end, but that's my presentation, and thank you very much for listening. Are there any questions, any comments? Susan.
One very trivial question. When you talked about the 50,000 theses from ProQuest, are those McGill theses?
Yes. Those are McGill. McGill theses.
Historically collected into ProQuest.
That's correct. And rather than go through the whole process of scanning the paper documents, we have the paper documents, but rather than scan them, ProQuest has already scanned them. So.
I see. When did they get into the business of scanning theses at the university?
Well, this is University Microfilms International.
I remember
UMI.
James Harris.
Yeah.
So it comes out of that.
Yes.
The other thing was you said if Canada has 40 repositories and the U.S. has 335, proportionally speaking, Canada's ahead because we're
okay.
Bigger 10 to 1.
You're right. You're right. You're right.
So if we're 40, that means they have
yeah. 400. Yeah. But some of them were, if you look at, you can go to the Open Door site and they actually list them all. Some of them were questionable,
yeah.
I think. But then I'm sure that in the U.S. list, some of them are questionable as well.
Phantom.
Yeah.
But the other much more interesting to me question is this whole, because I'm in a community of archivists, numbers, people called IASIST, where they are working on this whole attempt to drive the idea of usability of data, etc. And there they have spoken to the problems with formatting and have moved to a completely HTML, XML, just tagging in an attempt to make data usable as possible from the websites. And I guess this is probably where these kinds of things can come together, is there's more and more systems driven on a kind of tagging basis. It's called DDI, which is Data Documentation Initiative. And it basically allows you to bring that information into into Notepad, anything that you can use, which will need your ASCII text and your interpret your tags.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's again a place where there's going to be a confluence between people working with the printed materials and people working with the numeric data materials.
Can you see that DDI technology being applied to the data that is produced by researchers at McGill?
And
we have the technology.
Been in touch with some researchers who are interested to undertake this.
What is not clear is how Digitool would handle that, but that's
That was the thing that in terms of where I'm talking about the discussions are going on, and that there has to be at what point down the road do they begin to merge. At the moment, Digitool doesn't seem to have that kind of focus that makes it easily mergeable at the moment.
No. But Ex Libris is working on it. I think even they are aware that this is becoming increasingly important. For a while, they just didn't seem to be doing anything with it, but now they're making many announcements where, as I said, that we're going to be using, that they're going to be adding reporting tools, and they say that they're working on developing it, and they've even set up a little wiki for developers of the API, so they're investing in it. So there's that possibility, but there are other products out there as well. You?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. First, I wonder if there's any conflict of interest with the publishers who earn the money through their business. If we, the university, make a separate or something duplicating the repository, are there kind of issue on that?
Is there a conflict of interest? Well, we're
publishers seems like hesitant. Copy or a photocopy of the same items. If we have here in McGill, I don't want to go to publisher, we don't need to pay access charge, I'll just use this copy. So I know this is a big movement, so how the publishers kind of have this kind of movement?
Oh, the publishers are not happy, there's no doubt about that. But the question is this a movement that is developing in response to developing technology, and it's seen as a greater good, a social benefit. It's perceived that there's a social benefit to institutional repositories. Consider, for example, it makes so much information available to developing countries that they would not have otherwise have access to. There's certainly politics around it. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know that I would describe it as conflict of interest. Certainly we pay the publishers, and we as a library spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on these.
Also, in the copyright issue, you know, if you publish article in written form, the publishers own the copyright. And then, but here, this is the previous version I deposited in IR at McGill. And then similar content. With the same data.
The publisher gets the copyright if the author signs it over to them. That's part of the agreement.
We have to sign it. But here, you know, we don't need to sign any kind of copyright.
No, because this is covered by the McGill Policy on Intellectual Property. The contributors completely retain their copyright.
I guess it can make some kind of a lot of issues and some problems in the future.
Aside from the ones we mentioned, I'm not sure. I mean, there's growing pains. There's sort of like areas where there's friction, and we have to deal with them. Pardon me?
Yes, we improve more access.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so
that is what we're trying to do. But in some cases, for example, we will put a link, we will put the preprint or the postprint in. There is the Open Door, I didn't go into too much detail with it, but they have a website called Sherpa, where they list all of the publishers and the degree in a way to, or the types of open access they will allow their contributors. Some of them will allow preprints, some will allow postprints, some will allow none, some will allow open access if you pay a fee, and we've already been asked, will the library pay those fees? We won't. So there's many, many models to work with. So it's not so black and white. I think publishers are recognizing that they have to deal with this, and there have been some, they've been working on developing some business models, one of which is the pay us and you get open access. The other one is that the contributor pays and then access is open. But there are other business models being worked on out there as well. So I think publishers realize they have to come to terms with this. I don't know that it necessarily means they'll go out of business, but yes, there's no doubt it will impact what they do.
Their business, I think. And another thing is, I know the PDF file, I think it's a good way to just view only users, whoever want to access, to be allowed to view, but I don't want to take the content and the take on their own purpose. That's why PDF file is much better way, protective way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. You mentioned that the PDF file does not allow repurposing of the content. I think it's good, rather than XML or other just mm-hmm. original, you know, file format, document format, and whatever format, they can just take and use whatever, you know, device easily. So that PDF file is on purpose. I think it's good, right? Memory.
It definitely serves its purpose. What I can envision happening as the technology develops is that we'll be able to apply digital rights management at a very granular level to the contents of the repository, so that if something is not to be repurposed, then it will have that rights management aspect around it. But if there's something else that can be, so it's, I don't think it will be that everything in a repository can or cannot be, but I think I think we'll end up with a variety of formats in the repository. And then the whole question comes, how do we curate? How do we take the original and preserve it while still making it available for repurposing? There's that approach as well. But you can do both.
Because certainly the use of copyright over the past 15 years or so has been very difficult. I mean, once the photocopy machine was in the building, how much was out there that really had, was just not legally out there, but people copied it and used it and put it in all kinds of other forms. And it's at the sort of grassroots level, this has always been the way people have exchanged information. They don't pay much attention to the big format. Now I think we're kicking it up a notch so that it becomes, more attention will be paid to it. But then again, I think you're right, that what you have to do is simply say to people, be somewhat in charge of it, right? Try to arrange so that if you really feel something is, you don't want others to be having it easily accessible. Because if somebody really wants, they'll sit and copy it out by hand. The idea that somebody is never going to get the words that you've spoken copied into their own words is pretty hard to prevent.
Well, that's the underlying philosophy of the Creative Commons licensing approach, which is it's the author who decides this is what you can do with it and this is what you can't. Juanita?
What is the situation currently? Like, if somebody's put an article there and somebody would like, say, translate it into another language, who do they go for to say, can they do it freely because it's in the e-scholarship for free, or they should still be approaching somebody at McGill to say, hey, we would like to do this. you know. What if they want to do it for profit? Not, you know, because I could say I'm going to translate this and I'm going to put it in the Creative Commons or in the repository of my university for my students, whatever, who cannot read it because they are in another, you know, underdeveloped country in Spanish, for example. Mm-hmm. I would still need to approach somebody. Is that all a good grading being defined, or is it still a bit of a, you know, try to find and, you know, you're not guilty if you didn't find it or something?
So again, not a lawyer, but I think I'm fairly confident in saying if you take a document and translate it and try to sell that translation, you're breaking copyright. Much of the from what I understand of copyright jurisprudence revolves around whether somebody was making money off somebody else's work. If somebody's not making money, things are not quite as bad. But in your case, yes, that would be a clear infraction. You'd have to deal with the copyright holder, get permission. Now, mind you, sometimes getting permission is not all that difficult. As I said earlier, we will deal with publishers. For example, for books, where this is getting a bit outside of the repository, but for our other digitization efforts, we are looking to digitize many, many of our rare books. Some of them are still, most of them are in the public domain because they are so old, but some of them are still covered by copyright. In those cases, we'll write to the publisher and we'll ask for permission, because if the book's out of print, often they will give you permission, so you can't necessarily assume that they'll say no. They might say yes, especially if they're, you know, nobody's making any money out of it.
I have another question, and it's regarding the e-print process, because I can see that for e-theses, it's quite easy to get people and even reward them if they give it to you like that. What is the approach that we're currently taking to get the professors to voluntarily put their preprints and postprints, etc., or research papers?
Well, the instructions are on the website. I mean, for the actual mechanics, how it works, how you do that. No, we're working. This is the reason I'm here today, is that we're going to begin going out. As I mentioned, we do have someone on parental leave, so we've been. It's taken us a little bit longer, but we rely on the liaison librarians as well to help spread the message. We can't do it all of our own. People like you, Juanita, who speak with researchers, speak with members of faculty, we do count on you, but we want to make sure you've got all the right information, so I'll be speaking with the liaison librarians as well. I think we have a question here.
A quick question back to the copyrights and or relating to Creative Commons is, what is the default policy for documents being submitted within the scholarship? Has McGill adopted an open access policy as the default, or Creative Commons, or
it's open access, freely available.
Okay, and
but the author retains copyright, so that doesn't mean it's in the public domain, but it is accessible. So you can read it, you can download it, but you can't start selling it, you can't start trying to change it. You can't make it into a podcast, for example.
It is a Creative Commons.
To say that, we would have had to license it under Creative Commons, and we haven't. It's something we're considering, but we haven't licensed the repository under Creative Commons.
And you provide the authors with the flexibility at the middle time of their works to choose a licensing type at this point, or
we could. I don't know that we ever have. Because usually they've been satisfied with the McGill intellectual property policy. But yes, it's something we can make sure they know. That's a good suggestion. But I think we need to consider whether we want to, as you suggested earlier, whether we want to adopt Creative Commons as our default. Something we're still considering. There are many decisions we have to make, but we've decided we can't let that stop us. We still want to go ahead with what we perceive to be this very we hope is a valuable service. You have another question?
A follow-up as to the efforts in terms of digital media, because this obviously is easiest or most accessible to print media or digital formats, such as PDFs, documents, Word, and other ones. What are the current video or audio repository assets that you have, and do you have any technology in place to take care of those at this point?
We don't. One of the drawbacks of PDFA is it doesn't allow multimedia content. So it's some, again, one of those things we have to consider how we're going to deal with. So currently, as far as I'm aware, now there may be something embedded and in a thesis somewhere and that I don't know about. I know there's certainly images in there, but multimedia, not yet. But again, it's not something we're saying no to. We just don't have the underlying technology to support it yet. But yes, definitely. You know, one of the reasons we're so proud of Cuisine, the e-journal, is that it has a strong multimedia component. I think there was a question here.
Yeah, I haven't tried recently, but a year or so ago, I sort of put myself forward as a volunteer to have my stuff put in a deposit. Mm-hmm. And it was very nice that somebody from the library was going to look into all the issues about copyright and which ones were allowed to go in and which ones were not. But the problem seemed to be that it became extremely labor intensive to figure out which articles could in fact go into the repository. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering how feasible it is for you to get, you know, with the resources that you have, to actually get a large fraction of the papers that are published at McGill screened and into the repository.
We've hired some new staff recently, so to make sure we have the support that we need. Was there a final resolution to that, or did it just if you'd care to send me, I'll make sure that they're taken care of. I just want to clarify too that, of course, there's no guarantee that we will successfully negotiate. If a publisher has the rights to it and doesn't want to allow something to be deposited into the repository, then we can't do it, but we will attempt to change their mind.
I mean, I looked at that Sherpa database at one point, and it's very confusing to try to figure out, you know, if an article in a certain year in a certain journal, preprint, e-print, or, you know, post-print, you can remember the difference between those two. How many people do you think you need to be working just on getting permissions or establishing whether you have permissions?
Right now, I must admit, our requests are not numerous. So right now, we can handle it. We do have two additional staff now who are doing not just this, who are doing other digitization activities as well. But I would certainly be prepared to move into this if the demand increases. The library has a very strong commitment. The library director has said that she wants this to work well, so I think we will grow as we need to.
Because I've been holding back a bit on trying to convince other people in my department to do this, because I had the feeling that, in fact, there was this problem. Mm-hmm. But if you're saying I should really try to push everybody to do it and you take care of it.
But let's start. But if we can start with a few of other things, we'd be happy to start with you, and then you can judge for yourself. Gordon, you haven't had a chance yet.
I'm just wondering, the strategy that's been utilized trying to get agreements with publishers is probably the best one. But I'm wondering if there's any efforts being made to lobby at the federal government level to change copyright legislation to perhaps give an exemption for deposit in digital repositories in certain institutions. Now, this may be something that's being done. I know in archives they lobbied for about 10 or 15 years to get the right to make copies for preservation purposes. Okay, so I think probably the best route to go, from what I've seen, is probably the route with the publishers and working it out with them. But I'm just wondering if that's been a strategy that's been utilized by librarians to lobby the government to change copyright legislation to make more flexibility in that area so that someone could publish but still also deposit it.
Well, I know the Canadian Library Association is very active in lobbying the government for copyright law in general, legislation in general, but I don't know that they've been lobbying specifically for repositories. I think they're more concerned right now about the music aspects of it. But Sorry.
In some ways it's very difficult to do because the author lobby is extremely strong, and it is a difficult road. And I'm not surprised that it hasn't been traversed.
Well, the other aspect of copyright law that, according to our law librarian, and I hope I've got I'm quoting his right, quoting it right. Copyright law is one of the few areas of law that can be superseded by an agreement. You can't decide to have a contract to murder someone. I mean, you couldn't do that, but you can have an agreement which overrides copyright law. So even if the federal government, as I understand it, were to change the law, that wouldn't prevent, I guess, unless specified in the law, that wouldn't prevent a publisher from creating a contract that says, no, this doesn't pertain to our agreement. But where we see the hope is that with the funding agencies, and more funding agencies are stipulating that research results have to be available, openly accessible. Again, not mutually exclusive. You can still publish them with a publisher. There may be value-added features that a publisher can add, and I think some of them are looking at that. Here you want the plain vanilla product. Here it is. You want something with other added information. I'm not sure what, but here it is. So. Susan?
This might be of more general interest. I get PhD students who come to the lab because they can use PDFA in our ERS. And a number of them come, and then I also get telephone calls from people who are attempting to do it in other places, and they have some problem, some font problem or something about the table, or something is going on. Is there now a general number to call for such queries or a person to contact? As of like November, I wasn't very sure, and then when Jovia went on internal interview, I think at one point she was handling some of that. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone at the library?
Oh yes, we still handle those questions, and we also suggest to students that they try ICS because often it's there's technical aspects that ICS can help them with, but we're still assisting them. We get emails to the general e-scholarship at McGill email, and through liaison librarians as well. So yes, we are still assisting people with that. Sometimes it's tricky to convert into a PDFA. We know that. Sir,
you showed something about an addendum which I didn't catch.
The author addendum?
This is an addendum to the copyright agreement?
It's an addendum to the agreement between a publisher and an author.
Right.
That's SPARC, the Scholarly Publishing and Academic Research Coalition. I'll read the second paragraph. The Canadian Association of Research Libraries and SPARC has released the SPARC Canadian Author Addendum, a new tool for authors in Canada to retain key rights to the journal articles they publish. Traditional publishing agreements often require that authors grant exclusive rights to the publisher. The new SPARC Canadian Author Addendum enables authors to secure a more balanced agreement by retaining select rights, such as the rights to reproduce, reuse, and publicly present the articles they publish for non-commercial purposes. It will help Canadian researchers to comply with Granting Council output access policy, such as the Canadian Institute of Health Research policy on access to research outputs. The Canadian addendum reflects Canadian copyright law and is an adaptation of the original U.S. version of the SPARC author addendum. Obviously, it's easier if you do this before you sit down with a publisher, but in some cases, I believe, and again, I'm not a lawyer, that the addendum might be able to be invoked afterwards, but that's what we would discuss or attempt to discuss with a publisher.
If I'm submitting an article to be published, and the publisher tells me I have to sign this particular form, how are they going to react when I try to...
when you say no?
What is the experience?
Most people don't like that. Most people want to try the experience. So it's what we would hope to do, and I have not personally, I know that the e-scholarship coordinator was involved in this. I haven't personally done this, so I can't speak from experience. I can speak from what I've read and what I've heard others say, is that we will attempt to arm you with the facts, but often, as I said, sometimes the prestige of the publisher is a very strong factor, and it really is ultimately your decision if they're not agreeable to this, but you want to be able to publish with them, then it is your decision. And you might still be able to deposit preprints or postprints. And we are, and sometimes we put a link within the repository to the actual published article as well, and the publisher is agreeable to that. It's not ideal, but we can do that as well.
So the notion of visiting is to give us something to try.
Well, it's to arm you with the knowledge that there are alternatives, that it's not necessarily the publisher's agreement that has to be signed. If you're looking for Canadian facts or figures or experiences, I think it's more American, but we can do some research for you if you think that might assist you. If you can say these people or so and so was able to do this, that might help. But ultimately,
I have to say that from an academic's point of view, the choice of the journal is not based primarily on whether it's the institution is possible. I mean, much as I would like to base my decision on that. Okay.
It's understandable. But our hope is that eventually the repository will become so strong and so prominent that it will rival. It's not there yet, I know, but it will rival the publisher. Other
last question?
Okay, I'm wondering if e-scholarship actually improve access to kind of study, or simply have some kind of statistics and watch how many person actually access each document every day, or do you have a count of some?
No, unfortunately, DigiTool doesn't have that capability. The vendor is working on giving us that reporting capability. It's certainly something we would want for our own purposes as well. You're quite right to evaluate the success of it. We can get very, very macro figures, but they're not very very relevant, we don't find. But yes? Oh, yes.
So after years, we need to do kind of usability study. This really improve access to electronic dissertation rather than paper or microfilm versions of saying.
But again, because, well, in the theses, for example, they're all cataloged, so they're in the catalog as well. So there are different ways of accessing them. And they're well cataloged, you know, they're well described in the catalog. That's it?
Thank you very much. Please don't move too far away because you're wired. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I might explode.
Yes. they'll never hear me otherwise. Yeah. So thank you very much. Very stimulating ideas on copyright and publishing and the future of publishing at McGill. It's really good.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Say sorry about the coffee. Okay. Just to let you know that our production people in the back, our directors and producers, have new software, a new system, lecture recording system. Is that true? MediaSite Live is being replaced by a lecture recording system.
Cool.
Oh, you're using Cool now.
Which is really nice.
Oh, cool.
And
Very good.
Shine the camera. Yeah. It won't twist that far. Yeah. Okay. Well, just so if you've seen this today and you like it or don't like it or whatever your comments are, please give them to at this following email address: multimedia.ncs@mcgill.ca, just to get some feedback about this. So thank you very much.
Who's our next speaker, Gord?
The next speaker. Thank you very much. Yeah. This is good. This is good. We actually have two speakers. It's an ICS presentation, February 17th, 2009. And one presentation will be by Riyadh Zini, creating a single resource to access decentralized computer facilities. And the second presentation will be by Gabrielle Krim on looking for IT answers, browse our service catalog. So we look forward to seeing you on 17th of February, 2009. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.